This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. It is an envelope and an organ. It's a canvas in a range of colors, a sepia rainbow. These are some of the ways anthropologist Nina Jablonski describes our skin. She is our guest in this portion of the program. Nina Jablonski is the author of Skin, A Natural History, which she describes as, quoting here, an idiosyncratic guidebook replete with personal detours to topics about skin that have engaged her in her work. She says she's enjoyed learning about the skin of animals, including bats and hippos, as much as she's enjoyed learning about our human skin. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Nina Jablonski is professor and head of the Department of Anthropology at the Pennsylvania State University. Her research on human skin has been featured in National Geographic, Scientific American, and other publications. Skin, A Natural History is published by the University of California Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Jablonski, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi. Wonderful to be with you.
Oh, it's so nice to talk with you. What a fun read this was. How poetic you are in your descriptions of our skin.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. Some of the reviewers have called me geeky.
Oh.
So poetic is something I haven't heard a lot of. That's nice.
Oh, I just love that. A sepia rainbow. That's lovely.
Well, that's really what it is. When you look at these wonderful old sepia photographs, I mean, basically, human skin comes in just those colors. And so that's what it seemed best to describe.
Hmm. We began with the Cole Porter tune, I've Got You Under My Skin.
Yes.
And, you know, that's just one of the expressions about skin that we're familiar with. We use these expressions all the time. Would it be fair, though, to say that on the one hand, we're very aware of our skin, and on the other hand, we generally take it for granted?
Yeah, completely. I mean, like most of our bodies, we never really think about our skin unless something goes wrong or unless we really want to undertake some major change of it. We don't think about our pancreas. We don't think about our teeth very much unless there are problems with either of those. And the skin is just, I guess, probably the largest and most important thing that we take for granted in our bodies. But we certainly use it very much to identify with the idea of being a person. The whole idea of getting under one's skin, or, you know, I was, you know, scared out of my skin. We use clearly the skin vision, the skin symbolism, to mean much more than just the organ. It means ourselves. It means our humanness. It means our own personality.
Yeah, and without it, where would we be?
Absolutely. I mean, because it is this extremely important physical and physiological envelope for our bodies, and we project so much of our personal selves and our cultural selves on its surface. So it's this, you know, it's this wonderful multi-purpose sort of glad wrap.
That's a wonderful way to think of it, too. You know, we're familiar, of course, with goosebumps. You said, you know, I was scared out of my skin.
Yeah.
And when we've been frightened, we might say something made our skin crawl.
Oh, yes.
Cold, sweaty palms also come with fright. And if we're embarrassed, we blush.
Yes.
As you put it, our skin often thinks before we do.
Completely. I mean, the skin is an organ of the body that responds to conscious as well as subconscious stimuli, and often reacts, you know, to emotional stimuli in a very direct way, often in ways that we hadn't anticipated or even in unwanted ways. I'm sure most of us can remember times when we have been embarrassed and have blushed furiously in a public place, and you know, and have felt, oh my goodness, you know, you just want to crawl under whatever surface is available because your face is turning red, or you just feel so incredibly uncomfortable. And so, yes, our skin thinks often when we aren't thinking, because it responds to the autonomic nervous system in the body, which is sort of our maintenance nervous system that keeps our bodily functions healthy and going. And so because it is so responsive to this sort of involuntary nervous system, it often betrays many things to other people that we don't think about. This is one of the reasons that people feel self-conscious about blushing. They feel self-conscious about sweating, and they worry when they take or have to take something like a lie detector test, because their skin often can tell something about their inner selves that they don't want the rest of the world to learn.
Why do we have this mechanism that, for example, makes us blush when we're embarrassed? Why?
Well, I think, I mean, it's very hard to know, of course, and it's hard to reconstruct many of these details because we don't have fossilized skin, in a sense, fossilized skin physiology to fall back on. However, when we compare the responses and appearance of our skin to those of our closest relatives, we can make some good evolutionary reconstructions for why we blush and betray our emotions in this way. And my feeling, based on comparative study, is that we have these visible signs of emotion because they're very important as part of the human communications repertoire. As humans, communication is our big thing, and we are visual communicators. We don't necessarily smell one another very much, although we do some of that. We rely, for the most part, on visual cues, and we get those cues from facial expressions, from postures, from gestures, and from the appearance of the skin. And so if we see someone who is drained of color, as in a very fearful face, or if we see someone who is, you know, with an incredibly ruddy face, reddened and their eyes bulging out, that's a very good sign of we want to keep distance because of anger. Yeah. Blushing also lets us know that someone is embarrassed or feels uncomfortable in a situation. It gives a visual signal that can be perceived from a distance of, you know, quite a few feet or meters. So it allows us to gain an emotional read on a person without actually having to exchange words.
And the blush can be attractive.
Oh, yes. And, you know, in fact, the fact that it does betray things that we wouldn't want to necessarily talk about is often what's so attractive about it. And, you know, authors over the years have alluded to, you know, the maiden's blush, you know, betraying her affection for this or that young suitor. And this is, you know, absolutely, it can be very, very attractive and used very much as a signal of, you know, yes, I'm getting somewhere with this person. Yes, I'm on the right track.
Yes, we've all had someone say to us in a flirtatious way, I think, you're blushing.
Oh, yes. 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 Or, you know, or if someone has been goading you, you know, in middle school or high school, you know, oh, you're blushing. And then they'll torment you to make you blush even more. So it can be used in a provocative sort of sexual way or proto-sexual way, and also a bit in you know, usual sort of teenage taunting.
Yeah. And it's also something many women will put on.
Oh, yes.
In the morning.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because, of course, as one gets older, one tends to not spontaneously blush as much. And so if you still want to feign a bit of that youthful vigor and blushing ability, well, there are about 7,000 different types of of powders, creams, and other unguents that you can apply to your cheek area to feign just this this emotion. So we like it. We like to be able to either put it on naturally or put it on artificially. And in fact, women love to be able to modulate the amount of color that they have according to the social situation that they're going to enter into.
Mm. And it also can be an indicator of health.
Very much so. The blush of health, I mean, the expression. And so even if you don't feel all that chipper on a particular morning, you know, you put a little extra, you know, ruddiness in your cheeks, and you convince the rest of the world that you're feeling better, and sometimes it makes you feel better about yourself.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, it's better to look good than to feel good.
Yeah.
Isn't that the...
And also, there's so much feedback involved in, you know, sort of looking at oneself and having feeling good about the way you look, and also getting feedback from other people about the way you look, that projecting a positive image and having people respond positively to that image can be very reinforcing and can actually make you feel better.
Hmm. How
so it's not all artifice.
Right, right. How different is human skin from the skin of other animals?
Well, actually, it's quite a bit different. And one of the fascinating things to have emerged from the Human Genome Project and the recently completed Chimpanzee Genome Project is some of the biggest differences between us and our closest evolutionary relatives, chimpanzees, are actually in skin. Human skin is unique in that it is actually tougher. It can resist a lot more physical abrasion than the skin of our animal relatives because our skin is effectively naked. We don't have a nice coating of hair or fur to protect it from bumps and bruises and abrasion. And so the outer layer of our epidermis is actually tougher and more waterproof than those of other animals, even our closest relatives. And so this is fascinating.
Yeah. And another thing in addition to our nakedness is we're sweaty.
Oh, incredibly sweaty. And this turns out to be an enormously important part of the human evolutionary story. You'd think, oh my goodness, you know, what does sweat have to do with, you know, human evolution? Well, it probably has a lot to do with it insofar as sweating is our way of keeping cool. And keeping cool is extremely important if you're an active mammal. Sometimes we think, oh, it's more important to keep warm, and in certain climes, of course, keeping warm is important. But much more important in the context of early human evolution, which took place in equatorial regions, is how did we manage to keep cool? Because if you're exercising in a hot place, you build up a huge heat load as a result of your muscles working and sun beating down on you. And that heat load needs to be dissipated. Otherwise, your brain can overheat, and that can have tremendously serious consequences. And we as primates dissipate heat largely through sweating. And humans have become incredibly good sweaters. We have about 5 times as many sweat glands as your average non-human primate. That's per square inch of our skin. And so that allows us, well, it effectively gives us a huge cooling surface on our bodies through which the many blood vessels flow. And as sweat evaporates, the blood flowing under the skin becomes slightly cooler. And then as that returns to the heart and in the rest of the circulation, that keeps our bodies cooler. It's like having sort of a radiator, a car's radiator, spread over the surface of your body. It's the same principle. And that turns out in humans to be enormously important. Our big brains are very sensitive to overheating, and by having nice, freely flowing sweat on the surface of our bodies, which evaporates and cools, we keep our brain comfortable, and we can keep active in hot environments much, much better and more efficiently than other animals can.
We can keep working. We can keep running.
Yes.
If we need to do.
And in fact, what's so remarkable is that humans are, have been, and still are observed in many equatorial environments to be able to engage in long-distance running and pursuit hunting of animals that allows them to continue mile after mile after mile, even after the swiftest four-footed animals, you know, have tired out. And this has allowed, you know, humans to become superior hunters under these circumstances. And so this this ability to keep cool under conditions of very high heat and exertion has been a very great evolutionary plus for us.
By the sweat of our brow.
Absolutely. That's what made us.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is anthropologist Nina Jablonski. She's the author of Skin, A Natural History, and that's our topic this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What led you to your interest in skin?
Well, as many things in science, a complete accident. What happened many years ago, I was asked by one of my colleagues one day to give a lecture on skin to an introductory course in human biology. My colleague was going away on a conference visit. And I gladly agreed to do so. I had given some lectures on skin before. But I thought, given the context of this course, I really wanted to talk about the evolution of skin and why human skin looked the way it did and why it came in various colors. And I realized after preparing that lecture that there was woefully little known about it. There was a huge amount known about skin diseases from the context of dermatology. And there was something known about the basic structure of skin, of course, through anatomy and histology. But in terms of why human skin looked the way it did, and especially why it came in different colors, there was almost nothing. And so that's what really got me thinking. And you know, it was basically pure serendipity afterward, you know, finding out intriguing pieces of information, putting those pieces together, and really coming up with a very rewarding research program on human skin, and especially on the evolution of human skin color, which is my own specialization in research.
We've got a number of listeners waiting to talk with you.
Great.
This afternoon. First, we're going to go to a caller in Muhammad on line 3. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting discussion. I'd just like to make a comment, which is, I know, going to be a little bit nitpicking, but you referred originally twice to the fact that the skin thinks faster than the brain, and you explained clearly what was going on. And as you know, what's going on is that basically any kind of cognitive input or any kind of input into the brain follows two pathways for evaluation. One goes to the cognitive processing center, and the other one goes to the amygdala and then goes directly out, and those are the emotional responses. And you described that quite accurately. I'm actually just calling to complain that I think that we do a real discredit and disservice to people by calling an emotional response a sort of thinking, because cognitive processing is not the same thing as goes on when we have an emotional response. And I think when we talk particularly, and skin color is a prime example, and we talk about stereotyping, what we're doing is we're responding initially to what we see. And that's not even going through our brain. And there's nothing wrong with stereotyping or having views that people of certain color, for example, might have certain characteristics. What we need to do is to just stop and wait for our cognitive process to catch up and say, hey, a stereotype is just a generalization and doesn't apply to any particular individual. And we need to not act on our emotional response before we give it a chance to go through our cognitive part of our brain. And I think that that's a very important distinction for people to make in order to understand how other people are responding to things and how we deal with people, particularly of different color. There's always been an issue in this country about, well, why did Italians do so well and why did Jews do so well and other populations that immigrated and blacks didn't? And there may be a discussion of slavery, but the bottom line is, at least in my view, that basically, and I'm Jewish in origin, is that everybody got to change their name and everybody got to move where they were, but people of color, whatever color that might be, carry it with them. They can't hide it, and except for those who are passing. And that's been really the basic problem, to my view, at least one of them, in the melting pot, is that there's this tag that people have, and that we're responding to that on a very emotional level.
Okay.
So I just sort of want to make that comment.
Okay.
Yes, and I think that's a great point, because regardless of what color you are, when you see someone, you will formulate, or your body will formulate, an emotional response to the appearance of that person. And that emotional response, that, in a sense, uncensored response, is the one that is generated physiologically on the basis of our previous experience during our lives. And there's been a lot of fascinating psychological studies done on this in recent years to actually see, you know, what is it that people react to in human appearance in terms of faces, skin color, and so forth. And to distill a complex literature, perhaps a bit overly distill it, but the long and short of it is that a huge amount of our emotional response, this uncensored sort of limbic system response, is based on whatever situations that we have been most exposed to as small children growing up. And so if we're used to living in a segregated neighborhood of whatever color, that we will tend to view someone of a different color as being different. And that will be the emotional, in a sense, signal that is sent. And so it's not just that people with light skin might happen to see or emotionally react to people with dark skin in a particular way, but also just the opposite, that people with who grow up, who are dark-skinned themselves and who grow up with mostly dark-skinned people, will have similar basic physiological reactions to people who look different. And so there's this initial emotional response to difference in the first instance. But then you are absolutely right. We as humans have the ability to reflect and to process this initial emotional response. And we only know so well that in the history of humanity, many people aren't very good on this processing, you know, and that we've, and in fact, the importance of reflecting on, okay, this person looks similar or different, how am I going to act on this, often is lost on people, and they act consciously on the basis of their initial unconscious reaction. And so, you know, I agree completely with your statement that we need to think clearly about all of the processes, unconscious and conscious cognitive processes involved in perceptions of appearance and skin color, and that we especially take on board our responsibility as sentient humans for that cognitive bit to really kick in and say, okay, you know, I'm a cognitive Homo sapiens living in 2006, and this is how I want to treat other people, and this is how I'm going to treat them.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. I've got some other folks waiting. Let's go next to Champagne, a listener on line one. Hello.
Hi. One thing you might mention is that the skin is the most primitive and the biggest, the largest, and the most varied of sense receptors. By primitive, you know, even a simple amoeba will respond to touch. And in terms of size, of course, it covers the whole body. And just think of all the kinds of sensory experiences we have pain, hot, cold, itch, tickle, slippery, sticky, all those things. And it's as a sensory phenomenon, as an organ, it's really quite a remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. And in my book, I devote a whole chapter to the importance of touch, although I just, you know, digressed at great length about how visual we are as primates and humans. We have we attach tremendous importance to touch. And as the very famous late anthropologist Ashley Montague once said, touch is the mother of all senses. It is the sense that provides us with our earliest feelings of the environment and certainly our earliest sense of security. And that continues to be important throughout life, even in ways that we don't take cognizance of.
Yeah, the other thing about touch is that it can pick up form just like the visual system can.
Absolutely. And this is
And that's quite remarkable.
That's right. And it's very well known, for instance, in people who have been blind since birth or blind for long periods of time, that in a sense the touch system takes over for the lost visual system. And in fact, now that new brain imaging studies are able to be done on people with long-term blindness, we can see how areas of the brain that in sighted people are devoted to the interpretation of visual information, in blind people is devoted to the interpretation of touch information, and that the same three-dimensional complexity is conveyed. So people who are not sighted can actually see the world through their fingers.
Very interesting program. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Your previous response sort of preempted my question. It was about Ashley Montague and the significance of touching. Is it true that babies who are never touched but supplied with everything else really don't flourish?
Is
the skin often so eroticized that people sometimes develop severe anxiety about being touched. If you touch them, or even shake hands sometimes, or hug them, they always think it's a sexual advance, and they'll hit the ceiling sometimes.
Yes.
Is there any truth to that?
Yes. Well, first of all, to come to your question about touching and infants, touch is extremely important in the course of normal mammalian development, including human development. Infant humans, rat pups, all mammals require touch in order to grow normally. And in the absence of touch, there is definitely an absence of the ability to thrive and grow normally. So the bottom line is that touch is essential for the normal physiological processes that lead to the stimulation of growth hormone production. So that's the first part. And then throughout life, we rely on touch. And in young children and throughout our lives, we need touch to basically reassure us that social contacts are secure, and touch is used very much as social communication and reassurance, and to quell stress. It's an extremely important stress-reducing modality. Now, there are cultures that are very touchy-feely, as we say, and there are some cultures that are extremely touch-averse. And I'm sure you can think of examples of these from your own memory or your own observations. In American culture, it's quite interesting. We're quite touchy-feely at home. We tend to be very touch-averse in the workplace for a whole interesting suite of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, in many cultures that are touch-averse, both at home and in the workplace, one finds that touch does become highly eroticized, and that any kind of touch becomes extremely sensitive and sensitizing. And so that people, this is especially true in some Asian cultures that I've studied, where touch is very, very restricted to particular people under particular sets of circumstances, that any touch becomes highly eroticized and magnified by the brain. It becomes extremely important because it occurs so rarely. And so the human responds disproportionately compared to other people. This isn't something that is genetically determined, but it is something that is modified during the course of life experience. And so, let's say, a person from Japan who is raised in Japan, which is a fairly touch-averse society, both in the home and outside of the home, they tend to be very sensitive to touch throughout their lives. But a person of Japanese ancestry raised in the United States or Norway or whatever would have the norms of those societies. So humans are born being extremely touch-sensitive and craving of touch. We naturally touch one another, and we gravitate toward touching one another. But in many cultures, there has been the cultivation of a lack of touch to build up the ability of individuals to withstand emotional stress for various interesting cultural reasons. Yeah. And in those societies, one sees, you know, a great, touch becomes more sexualized and more emotionalized in general.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks.
Next we go to Chicago, line 4. Hi.
I'm rather touched by some of the things you've been saying. It's really grabbing me. But just a comment on the matter of touch at one more point. Massage and reflexology, acupressure, acupuncture, all relating to touch, of course, have been significant in maintaining or restoring balance to certain conditions that have been effective. And then to go further along the line, they've made some other recent observations in health regarding the temperature of the head. When a person may have indicated a condition of a stroke, that if the head can be kept cooler, their chances of survival are much greater. So you've been pointing out all these things in a very lucid manner, and I really appreciate the input there. I was going to make another point that gave rise to some of these expressions. Stop, look, and listen before you jump to conclusions.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And, you know, your point about touch in terms of therapies, massage therapy, acupressure, and so forth, is extremely well taken, because we know that these therapies are very efficacious in everyone from stillborn infants to disease sufferers to anxious and lonely people, that these therapies can be very efficacious. And this points to the basic importance of touch and the fact that many of us now live in touch-averse situations, and that touch can help restore normal function, normal emotional tone, as it were, very, very readily, more readily than other stimuli can.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. Listener in Champaign on line 3. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I've heard several references you made to Ashley Montague, although unless I missed it, I haven't yet heard you actually reference his phenomenal book, Touching the Human Significance of Skin.
Yes, yes. And well, that is the book that I've been referring to, although not in name, which is a phenomenal book. Yes.
Yeah, I came across it many times in my study of anatomy, so much that I decided I had to find it and read it. it's a wealth of information, knowledge, and insight. But one thing, and you may have mentioned this, but I didn't hear it. You know, I, in terms of evolution, in terms of development of people, is that the central nervous system and the skin arise from the same developmental layer in the embryo.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that has a great deal of significance in terms of the function of the skin. In fact, Montague actually said you could, in some ways, think of the brain as the internal component of the skin, which
is... That's right. It's a beautiful remark. Yeah, very well taken. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Our guest this afternoon, anthropologist Nina Jablonski. She's the author of Skin, A Natural History. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Maybe before we run out of time, we should spend a little time at least talking about the canvas that our skin presents us with.
Absolutely, because this is something that no other animal does, which is, you know, not only apply blusher to their cheeks, but apply all sorts of other things to various parts of their body by way of temporary or permanent decoration. This is one of the most important features of human skin, that we do use it to tell the world about ourselves. The cosmetics that we might wish to apply, but even more significantly, when people make a decision to make some permanent change to their skin in the form of a piercing or a tattoo or a brand, this is a very important statement about the way that they see themselves, how they want to present themselves, how they want other people to see them, and how they want other people to identify them. This is a topic of great fascination, and I'm continue to be fascinated by this topic myself, because permanent body alteration, especially tattoos, continues to be of increasing popularity. You know, one can hardly, you know, turn on the TV anymore without seeing some show about permanent body alteration and who's got the latest tattoos and so forth. It's fascinating to me that we are taking this decoration of the body surface to such great ends.
Hmm. How far back have we been doing this as human beings?
You know, we had a unique insight into this by virtue of the fact that the famous Iceman, Ötzi, the 5,000-year-old person from the late Neolithic times, who was discovered on the boundary of Italy and Austria in the Alps, frozen in a glacier about a decade or so ago, was found to have a series of 14 tattoos on his body. And at first, you know, people thought, oh, you know, very, very interesting, you know, he was decorating himself. But no, a lot of those tattoos are actually on his back. And so they're thought to have been, you know, ancient, possibly modes of therapy of some kind. We don't know why they were affixed, but certainly people had the abilities to perform really quite nice and you know, adept tattoos, you know, 5,000 and probably more years ago than that. We find today evidence on many Pacific islands of tattooing methods that may have preceded the population of these islands initially by people. And so, you know, one, if you take that argument, one can think that we've been engaging in tattooing possibly for more than 10,000 years, which is a fascinating concept.
Yeah.
Obviously, people like the idea of being able to affix permanent marks to their skin. It perhaps allowed people to identify themselves according to particular families or clans, or simply that it allowed people of a certain age, once they had achieved sexual maturity, to be able to label themselves, yes, I'm available, yes, this I have reached this stage in my life. I'm sure, started out using tattoos in fairly simple social ways, and now they have evolved into extremely complex social signals.
One of the photographs that's in the book is of a woman from Myanmar, Burma,
yeah.
And her facial tattooing, you say here on the caption accompanying the photograph, this was common until very recently there.
Yes, that's right.
And she was tattooed probably as a young girl. Well, I guess at the point of adolescence, let's say.
Yes, she was tattooed when she would approach marrying age, because it was considered important in her group that she stay in the group. And if her face was tattooed, then men in her own group would find her beautiful and attractive, but she would be wholly unattractive to would-be kidnappers from other groups. And so this allowed a very nice method of controlling, basically ensuring that you had a population of reproductive age women in an area, a very rugged part of the world, mind you, where population densities were very thin, and in an area where women couldn't really afford to leave their, if not their natal group, at least the group of closely associated clans. And so this was an insurance policy for this particular tribe against women being taken away to remote areas where they would reproduce for the good of other groups and not for their own.
Mm. And it isn't
fascinating. Yeah. The fascinating rationale for tattooing.
And it's also interesting that in some cultures, people are painted for various passages or important
yes.
moments in their life, marriage, coming of age, being welcomed as an adult into the
yes.
community.
Well, again, this comes back to the primacy of humans as visual animals. We use visual signals, and some of these, of course, are subtle things, blushes and skin color and so forth. But when we add our deliberate decoration to our pre-existing decorations, as it were, this adds to the moment and importance of these visual signals. And so when someone beholds another who has a particular paint style around their cheeks or their forehead or their eyes, that signifies, oh, yes, you have attained a certain age or you haven't, or yes, you're an elder to be respected. These signals add and are very complex and tell us a huge amount about the person without us having to engage them in dialogue. And I think that's one of the most important things about all of this skin as a canvas, is it allows us to get an instantaneous read on other people, on their position, on their age, on their aspirations, on their identity, even before we get within conversational distance.
Mm. That's a good word, read, going back to the idea of our skin thinking.
Yes.
And think, we should have said probably at that point in our conversation, it's surrounded by quotation marks, but read is kind of a good, we get a read.
I like the idea that we really read people's, you know, visual body language. Because we do, you know, take a very, you know, quick scan of these things. We, of course, as a previous caller alluded to, we have an emotional response
mm-hmm.
to these, and then a more conscious set of cognitive responses. And those responses are extremely complex. And, you know, we bounce all of those thinking responses around based on our previous imagery and our previous experience. Oh, yes, that's the face I associate with an elder or a respected person or somebody of newly minted reproductive age or, you know, someone who's you know, just a young child. All of these things, you know, enter into a rich bank of memory and are then processed, and we act appropriately the vast majority of time.
Mm. We've got to wrap up. I do want to ask you one more question, though. It's a fun question. What is the purpose of the intricate swirls that we find on our fingers, our palms, and the soles of our feet?
Well, you know, fingerprints, we always think of them in the context of forensic investigations these days, but the original function of fingerprints is to help us gain a good grip on slippery surfaces. Now, our primate ancestors really needed this to be able to gain a secure purchase on slippery branches or on slippery rocks or whatever that they might have been treading on. We still use our fingerprints to gain a secure feeling for various things. And you know this if you've ever had chance to burn your finger and you lose your fingerprints, comfort temporarily, your fingers don't pick up on things as easily, and you don't feel as sure-fingered as you might otherwise feel. And so fingerprints originally evolved to help us gain a secure feeling for our environment so that we could locomote accurately, but also feel things in our environment, pieces of food and other animals, so that we could get a sure feel for what they were all about. All of those things are made possible by the intricate little ridges and the tiny little openings of sweat glands that impart just a little bit of moisture that increase the gripping potential and sensitivity of the fingertips and toe tips, for that matter. Mm. So they're absolutely marvelous things. Have a good stare at them before you go to bed tonight and thank yourself for having them.
Get a grip.
Yeah, get a grip. Absolutely.
Nina Jablonski, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Nina Jablonski is the author of Skin, A Natural History. She's professor and head of the Department of Anthropology at the Pennsylvania State University. Her book, Skin, A Natural History, is published by the University of California Press.